Ezekiel, a personal message. Brother Malcolm, please.
It's been about 40 years since our late brother Charlie Mason toured this continent a couple of times, and it was brother Charlie that left me with three things. Of all the many visiting speakers that we've had from England, there are three things that I remember quite vividly from his tours. I don't remember which tour they were. Don't even remember which city he said them in, because we met him in at least three different cities. But he said three things that stuck with me. One of them was that he taught us a hymn. He was quite musical. He went through the hymn book and introduced us to a number of new hymns in our hymn book. And the one hymn that he taught us, we still sing with great gusto. It's number 99 in the current hymn book. Lift up to God the voice of praise. This is a hymn that Charlie introduced, has everything. It has a section in unity, a line in unison. It has a line for the ladies. It has a line for the men. It has a line in harmony, four-part harmony. And the accompaniment is completely independent of the melody, so everybody has somewhere to shine in this hymn. The difficulty is that when the Green Book came along, the male voice music was changed, and not many of the men in our congregation have noticed that. So I point that out to you in the spirit of what Brother Charlie said many years ago, because that is a hymn that we all enjoy. We were sitting around one evening over tea, sort of before or after, I don't remember his talks, but it was one of those times when you just sort of sit and get to know somebody. And Brother Charlie said that he had gone to his boss to arrange for his holiday time and tell him where he was going and so forth. So that he was going to North America on a preaching tour, and the boss said to him, well, what will you be doing there? Where will you be staying? What's going on? And he said, I don't know. I don't know where I'll be staying. I know the towns I'm going to. I know the topics that I'm going to talk on. I have no idea who's going to host me. And I have no idea what sort of food, what any of the hospitality that I will receive will be. And his boss couldn't get over that. But that, you see, as Brother Charlie said, is one of the things which we take so much for granted in our fellowship. It's a very enriching and a very rewarding part of being a Christadelphian, that you can visit people. You can meet people that you really have nothing else in common with. You just bump into them because you happen to be in a strange town. And you can be confident of hospitality. And that stayed with me from Brother Charlie. Another thing which stuck with me, and which really is the reason that I'm getting to tonight's talk from, was he talked about the first chapter of Ezekiel. And there's one phrase which we'll come back to, which stayed with me for these 40 years that he, and really fashioned my approach to this prophet. And then Charlie pointed out things which I had certainly read previously, but never really noticed. And that was this progression of the spirit. When Ezekiel was looking at the temple in vision from his vantage point in Babylon, that the spirit of God, this light, this brightness, rose from where it normally would be and moved, stayed as if it was not quite sure where it was going, whether it would go back into the temple or whether it was going to leave by the doorway, and then went off onto the Mount of Olives in the east side and disappeared. I had never noticed that progression before. But that sort of perked my interest in this prophet, because what we were looking at here were very graphic and very real demonstrations of what was going on in the minds and hearts of the people who lived at that point in history. So from that time on, this prophet has intrigued me. The other thing which you notice then when you sort of are interested in a piece of scripture is how infrequently other people mention it. And I can't remember an exhortation coming out of Ezekiel. I've visited a number of different meetings over the years, visited a number of times, of course, when you go to the same meeting when these things have come up. And in fact, last autumn, young brother was commenting that he was starting out his career on the platform, and he said, well, you know, what do you talk about? That was one of the first things he had to face. What do you talk about on a Sunday morning? Well, the answer was, well, look at the readings. They take that as your subject. And this young brother, he gave a very fine exhortation. I have nothing to criticize in what he said, but his introduction was that, well, the first reading dealt with Solomon's temple, and that was a heavy subject. Didn't think he was going to tackle that one. The next reading dealt with Ezekiel's temple. Now, that was a very heavy subject, and that was, he left that with just two words, and so we moved on to the New Testament and took a few passages from there and moved on. The exhortation was fine, but the thing that struck me was that we had missed at least one aspect of the prophet Ezekiel, if that indeed was what many of us see in this prophecy. The prophecies in Ezekiel are complex, and they've attracted a great deal of interest, both within our fellowship and outside it. We have, for instance, a whole book written by a professional architect which seeks to unravel the scope and the nature of the temple, which is described towards the end of this prophecy. It's a work by a professional in his field. It's a little intimidating to think that you need to be a professional architect to understand the architecture which is there in Ezekiel. And I think many of us have this attitude. And then on the other hand, the first chapter, which was read to us this evening, has attracted attention from a very different source. In the 60s and 70s, there was a lot of discussion of one gentleman, Erich von Daniken, who wrote, among other books, The Chariots of the Gods. And he proposed that possibly we were looking at a flying saucer here in the first chapter of Ezekiel. This description of the wheels and the wheels which turned on their sides and the eyes all around it was very much like the descriptions that people who saw unidentified flying objects described. And so you see the prophet has attracted an enormous amount of attention from all sorts of people who have tried to interpret it from all sorts of points of view, and all of this has left us with the notion that Ezekiel is a very complex work. This evening, when we finally get to it, I want to concentrate on the simplicity of the man Ezekiel, because he does leave us with a very simple, a very personal, and a very moving message. But before we do that, let's sort of go back and recap a little of the history which is going on around this time. Babylonian Empire was starting to develop and was overtaking the Assyrian Empire. The Assyrians had been masters of the Middle East for a good many years. They had set up a system of trade throughout the Middle East, and they wished to control the nation of Judea for trade purposes, because there was this trade route which came from Africa up through Egypt, up along the coast, and then inland from there. This was an important trade route. It was even important for luxury goods in the palaces. We have, for instance, on some Assyrian bas-reliefs, pictures of African lions, which obviously had been transported from Africa through Egypt along this trade route, and then were used in the king's private game reserve so that the king could go out on personal hunting expeditions. That's just one example of the importance of the route within Assyrian thinking. Now, the Assyrian Empire was starting to shrink as we get close to the time when Ezekiel is talking. And the Babylonians are beginning to take over this part of the world. The Babylonian influence is being felt. Nebuchadnezzar led an army down into the Judean Empire in the late years of Josiah's reign. And he then established his influence in that part of the world, and Jerusalem then became a vassal of the Babylonian king. As to, with Josiah's death, with a battle which was took place between the Egyptians, the Assyrians, and the Babylonians, Jehoiakim took over as king, and the Babylonians took over the influence in the land of Judea. Jehoiakim then was a vassal of the Egyptians. Now, a year after this happened, Nabopolassar, who was Nebuchadnezzar's father, died. Nebuchadnezzar had to return quickly to Babylon to establish his rights to the throne, and it took him about a year to establish a firm grip on the Babylonian Empire. And then it was approximately 2 years then after Jehoiakim had been established as king that Nebuchadnezzar then decided that it was time to make certain of his territories along the Mediterranean coast, which included the land of Judea. He besieged Jerusalem, and Jehoiakim at that time died and left his son Jehoiachin to take over in his stead. which was all right. He then became a vassal of Babylon. Now, a year later, the Babylonian army tried to subdue Egypt, and there was an enormous conflagration. Both armies were severely mauled, and the Babylonians had to retreat back to Babylon to regroup to reestablish themselves and recruit new members and rearm and all those things that armies have to do. So you see, with the ebb and flow of politics, Jehoiachin decided that he then maybe the Babylonians were a spent force. He could assert his independence. He made a partial political union with Egypt. And the Babylonians then decided, once they had regrouped their army, that this had to be stopped and came back. And there was a very severe siege, which resulted in the deportation of a great many of the people from Judea, including Ezekiel, into Babylon. Zedekiah was put on the throne, and he reigned then for a number of years, and at the end of that time, he decided that the Babylonians had been forgotten, they'd gone away, they didn't seem to be paying any attention to what was going on, and so it was quite reasonable for him to assert his independence with the help, he hoped, of Egypt, but that didn't happen, and Zedekiah was in turn destroyed. At that point, we're told that only the poorest of the people were left in the land. This was standard practice when you took over a country, to leave somebody that was actually familiar with the terrain to run it for you. Because the point that was important here, as far as the overlords were concerned, was that tax revenue should be raised. This area was used for food production, olives and so forth. You needed farmers to produce it. So in each of the successive waves of conquest by the Babylonians and the successive removal of slaves, they gradually cut them down until all that was left were just those few people who could actually keep the farms going and provide that as a source of income to the Babylonian Empire. So in the middle of all this, then, we come into the first chapter of Ezekiel, and Ezekiel is by a river in Babylon on his own. He's lost his job. If you want to think of it in modern terms, he's lost his job. He's been taken captive. He's been imprisoned. He's been deported. He's in a country where he doesn't know the language. He's in a country where his job skills are absolutely no use to him whatsoever. And that's his personal situation. And that's what we find in the first two or three verses of this chapter. But before we actually start on that, just a little more background. There are six partial scrolls of Ezekiel which were found among the Dead Sea Scrolls. And there was one found on Masada, also a partial scroll. And many of our brethren that are interested in prophecy have commented on the scroll that was found on Masada for the content and for its timing, because it seems to indicate a real link between the establishment of Israel and the future of the return of Jesus. It's a coincidence, what was found there, and a remarkable coincidence. But of the seven scrolls which were then found in the Dead Sea area, they cover almost all of the chapters. There's about 40% of the content of Ezekiel in those scrolls. They cover everything from chapter 1 to chapter 43. And so it seems reasonable that the text that we have was there and known to the people who lived along the Dead Sea at the time of Christ. There's also an excellent correspondence with the Masoretic text, which is the text which we have as the basis for our Old Testament today. So we can say then that the words that Jesus read when he looked at the scroll of this prophet were the words that we have in our Bibles today. The other interesting thing is that this 37th chapter, the chapters that deal with the dry bones, the prophecy of the dry bones, that was an important chapter to the people who lived on the shores of the Dead Sea at Qumran. There were several scrolls, non-biblical scrolls, in which they comment on this particular chapter. And the people who lived in Qumran looked at the valley of the dry bones as being a prophecy dealing with them in their day, and the renewal then of their nation and their release from the situation that they faced in the Roman Empire. So what that does to us then is mean that the disciples' question, Lord, wilt thou at this time restore the kingdom to Israel, was a question that was on the minds of at least some of the people who lived on the shores of Galilee and down around the Dead Sea at the time when Jesus was there. So in other words, Ezekiel provides us with a link to Jesus and his time and his teachings. It illustrates that the things that we read in our New Testament were very much topics of conversation at the time when Jesus was there. The text we have is reliable then. The questions which were raised by our brethren at the time of Jesus are real, and the importance of them to people who lived at the time when Ezekiel was alive are also significant. First three verses of Ezekiel then really leave us with a very profound truth. And they leave us with a very real and a very deep personal exhortation. And it's things like the point which are made in these first three verses which really make me wonder why we don't use books like Ezekiel more frequently for our Sunday morning talks and so forth. Just come with me now. The date, the prophecy is given there in the first few words. When Ezekiel was among the captives by the river Kibar, that is, that the heavens were opened, and I saw visions of God, which was the fifth year of King Jehoiachin's captivity. The other interesting thing is that Jehoiachin was given a daily ration by the king of Babylon. In the British Museum now, there's the tablet from the royal records in Babylon, which describe the rations which Jehoiachin was given. So we know for a fact that Jehoiachin was a captive in Babylon. We know when he was there from the Babylonian records, which correspond to the dates which we can work out from our Old Testament. And so, once again, history just comes together and we see that what we're reading really was, really happened. The word of the Lord, the third verse, came expressly unto Ezekiel, the priest, the son of Buzi, in the land of the Chaldeans by the river Kebar, and the hand of the Lord was there upon him. What's so profound about that? What's so profound about that? Well, a little description we gave of Ezekiel earlier, he lost his job and all that, you remember that. What it really meant was that he was completely divorced from his normal surroundings, his normal practice. He was no longer in Jerusalem where he had been a priest. He'd been taken away from all physical contact with his religion and his mode of worship. He'd been set down in a land where nobody valued the things that Ezekiel believed in. And we can see from the book of Daniel how hard it was for people in Ezekiel's position to make their beliefs felt and hold their beliefs in that alien land. And as we work our way through the next few chapters, we'll see that there was plenty of disbelief among Ezekiel's cohorts when he was there in Babylon. And yet for someone who was far removed from his temple, far removed from all normal contact with his religion, God was there. So if we transpose these thoughts into modern terms, what it says to us is that it really doesn't matter where we are. It doesn't matter what circumstances we find ourselves in. It doesn't matter how difficult the position may be that we face at that particular time. If only we will look and listen, God is there. It's a very deep and very personal exhortation. It's a very profound teaching. And yet it's so simple. I was talking to one of our brethren about odds and ends the other few weeks ago. And he said, you know, I think it was your dad that said, we have a very simple faith. We do. It comes down to very simple and straightforward points of belief. Points like this. It doesn't matter where you are or what your circumstance. If only you will open your heart, God is there. Now, when I suggested that we talk about Ezekiel, I suggested to Brother Stephen that maybe we should have four talks on this, and he put two of them down in the present series and the two in the next series. What I want to do this evening is develop this point, this personal point about Ezekiel, his life, what he went through, and the things that he stood for and how difficulties were that he experienced in standing up for his principles, but that he never let them go. The personal message. We'll turn next, in the next talk, to the broader scope of the nation as a whole. And then, of course, there's the question of how these reflect upon us, the extension into the New Testament and into our era, which is very much because we are included. We are included in what Ezekiel is saying. That is as a third talk. And then we'll come back to some of these things that we've just talked about briefly, the wheels within wheels and so on, because all of the symbolism is present in various parts of our Bible. It's all traceable. It all has meaning. And yet, in many ways, we find it so intimidating. But there's really no need to consider much of it that intimidating. When I looked in the fourth verse, I'm just going to have a little look at it right now. When I looked, and behold, a whirlwind came out of the north, a great cloud and a fire and a brightness. There's three words, a fire and a cloud and a brightness. Now that should, to the most simple Sunday school scholar, should take us back to Moses. So one of the things that we've got right here is that all of this complex symbolism harks back to Moses in some way. So one of the things, and this, the least of the things that Ezekiel should have seen when he saw that vision coming, was that what God had said to Moses applied to him in the day in which he stood, in the circumstances in which he was, out of the land that Moses had led the people into. Even in those circumstances, those things still applied in his life. And when we work on down the beryl, which the gemstone which was there, was one of the stones in the breastplate. The sapphire, which is there further, the appearance of a sapphire stone in the 26th verse. That takes us back to the time when Moses saw a vision in the wilderness, and it stood upon a sapphire stone. You remember that. Again, we go back to Moses all the time in these prophecies. And then when you get to the end of the last but one verse, it reminds us of the rainbow. And that reminds us of God's assurance that he would not again destroy the world. That's an interesting thought. Because Ezekiel's world had been not completely destroyed, but severely damaged. And what Ezekiel was going to say in the next about 18 chapters is that that world is going to be completely destroyed in another dozen years or so. The rainbow was there to remind us that God would never yet again destroy the whole world, and that seed time and harvest, the things that sustain us in life, would continue. Again, they're the simplest of Sunday school lessons, and they're right here. And now, I'll tell you the phrase that impressed me the most about what my brother Charlie said those about 40 years ago when he was talking on Ezekiel. It's in the last verse. And Brother Charlie said, many men have expounded on the meaning of these symbols which are in the first chapter of Ezekiel. Many lesser men than Ezekiel have stood and expounded at great length on what those verses mean and seem to command and to understand them. But what Brother Charlie said is that look at the effect that that had on Ezekiel. And when I saw it, said Ezekiel, I fell on my face. It was a very humbling experience for Ezekiel. And that again is a very powerful and a very personal exhortation. How do we feel before the promises that God has set in front of us in our Bibles? How do we feel? Do we feel grateful and humbled, sincere in the face of them? And when I saw it, said Ezekiel, I fell on my face and I heard the voice. I heard the voice of one that spake. You see, in this first chapter, there is an enormous personal exhortation. It didn't matter what circumstances Ezekiel found himself in. These are the first three verses. God was with him if only he would listen. God showed him a vision. And Ezekiel was humbled and overawed by the presence and the majesty of God and what he was promised there. And Ezekiel listened. And I heard the voice of one that spake. This imagery is continued for us at the end of chapter 3. Saw the vision again. And I arose and went forth into the plain, and behold, the glory of the Lord stood there as the glory which I saw by the river Kebar, and I fell on my face. Again, Ezekiel was overawed. Spirit entered into me and set me on my feet. The Spirit entered into me and set me on my feet. It's quite similar to what happened to the Apostle Paul on the road to Damascus, isn't it? Where he was overawed by the presence and the brightness and the brilliance of God's, of this vision which he saw. And the voice said to Paul, arise. You've got a job to do, in so many words. And that's what happened to Ezekiel here. And the Spirit entered into me, set me on my feet, and spake with me and said, go shut thyself up within thy house. Now, this prophet, this man, had an extremely unpleasant job to do. He made himself very unpopular. You see, there was a form of peace in Jerusalem when Ezekiel was speaking at this time. He had been captive there for a few years and been taken captive with Jehoiakim and his immediate family and several of the other priests and a number of the other members of the sort of ruling class within Israel at that time. They had all been taken down to Babylon. But Zedekiah was still there. The temple was still secure. Sure, the Babylonians tell us very graphically of what they took out of the temple on each of their different pillaging expeditions, and much of the gold, much of the treasure from the temple, because the treasure was the sort of the temple was the central banking system for Judea at that time. That was where their gold reserves were held, and so forth. And that was where you went if you want to pillage, and the Babylonians had. But there was still something there. It had been pillaged, but it was still there. And so those who were surrounding Ezekiel on this occasion, yeah, they had problems. But we know from Persian records that many of them did very well. They entered the business world of the Babylonians. Many of them made themselves fortunes there. And when it was time to return, there was plenty of money that went with them back from under the Persians with Nehemiah and Ezra to set up their new kingdom in Jerusalem. So many of them were doing all right. Some of them were concerned about what was going on back home, all right, and we can see that in some of the words which you hear in the next six or seven chapters. But by and large, Ezekiel then was a voice, as it were, crying in the wilderness, as we hear of John the Baptist. In chapter 4, also, son of man, take thee a tile, lay it before thee, and portray upon it the city, even Jerusalem, and lay siege against it, build a fort against it, cast a moat about it, set a camp against it, set battering rams against it, take an iron pan, set it for a wall of iron between thee and the city, and set thy face against it, and so forth. And what Ezekiel is instructed to do in the next few chapters, I'll play out these little charades which talk about the final destruction of the city of Jerusalem under Nebuchadnezzar some 6 or 8 years later than the date in which he's speaking. So Ezekiel was saying both graphically and pictorially and in words that Judah and Jerusalem is going to come to an end, a very real end. They didn't pay much attention, it seems. These little charades, if you want to think of them as that, go on to the end of the 7th chapter. And the elders of Israel, we're told in several places, came to Ezekiel on repeated occasions. They must have seen these charades. They must have known what he was doing. And they kept then to themselves saying, why are you doing this? When we get to the end of the 20th chapter, you'll see a plaintive little statement by Ezekiel that they say, I speak in parables. In other words, you're just talking a bunch of picturesque language, which may or may not happen, we don't know. But nonetheless, even though, when you can see in that little picture which he was supposed to describe there, a plate with a drawing of the city, a wall around it, a moat around it, siege conditions, there could really be no doubt about what he was describing. They said, that's just talk. That's just talk. In our next talk, we'll talk a little more about those particular images and so on. But for tonight, I want to just pick up something in the 8th chapter. Now, the 8th chapter is, again, a very significant chapter and one that we will have to deal with at considerable length. We'll probably deal with that almost entirely in our next talk. But for this evening, I just want a few sections out of the end of this 8th chapter. This 8th chapter deals with the many things that were going on within Jewish society at that time. It's interesting that the archaeologists, the Kenyans, starting with the Kenyans in their excavation in Jerusalem, have found plenty of evidence of little images of foreign gods which were in and around the time of the site of the temple. And more recently, a number of Israeli archaeologists have been digging in this area and have found the same sort of things. So we know, we have a very good knowledge of what had been going on in Jerusalem just before the Babylonian conquest. They had actually imported all kinds of different deities from all over the place into their temple surroundings, and some of them, it appears, into the temple itself. Now, it's also quite clear that the Judeans were thinking, their thinking had been influenced by all of these different religions which surrounded them at that time. Now, one of the ways of thinking which was prevalent in the time that we're speaking of here, in the period that we're speaking of here, was that each god had its own territory. The god of the Philistines controlled the territory that the Philistines lived in. Egyptian gods were paramount in Egypt. The Babylonian gods were controlled Babylon. That was their territory. And in Isaiah, we have this challenge and a rather well-known orator, that have any of the gods of any of the nations round about been able to stand against the god of this invading power? The answer was no. And in the cylinder that we borrowed back for the Bible display that we had a couple of years ago, the Cyrus cylinder, there's an interesting little description on that little ovoid cylinder, that it was the Babylonian god that had permitted the Persians to enter Babylon because the Babylonian kings had not been behaving themselves the way the God wanted them to, and so the Babylonian God allowed the king who was presently there to be overtaken by the Persians. You see, the thinking was that each god controlled the space that that god's people lived in. The Israelis, the Judeans, call them as you will, also seem to have been tainted by this way of thinking. When they took the ark into battle against the Philistines, that was the thinking that propelled that decision. So, in the words that we have in the first chapter, those first three verses, when the God of Israel visited Ezekiel in Babylonia, what that was harking right back to the first book of Genesis, where we have the assurance that it was this God of Israel, Yahweh, who had formed the earth, set men upon it, and was God over the whole of the territory. The Jewish people should have known that. But we know from profane writings of the period that they certainly didn't present that as a dominant point of view. They seem to have been influenced by this thought that their God was restricted to the area where they lived. So, when we look at the 16th verse of the 8th chapter, what do we have? He brought me into the inner court of the Lord's house, and behold, at the door of the temple, between the porch, about 25 men, with their backs toward the temple of the Lord, their faces toward the east, and they worshiped the sun toward the east. We have another god which was being worshiped in the temple. Now, Mackenzie Avenue doesn't run quite east and west, but good enough for our purposes right now. So you see what's happened. The entrance to the temple is over on the east. The holy place is on the west. And the people in the courtyard of the temple are waiting for the sun to rise as part of one of their daily religious rituals. The Spirit of God, the light which was about to leave the temple, was behind them. In other words, they had literally, as well as figuratively, turned their backs on God. And as they turned their backs on God, God left that temple. And we'll come to this in more detail in our next talk. But you see, the personal message there is just the reverse of what we saw when Ezekiel was among the captives by the river Kibar. And God came to him there. But God left those people who would turn their back on him in the place where God had set up his sanctuary. On the one hand, it didn't matter where you were, whatever your circumstances, God would be with you. But if you turn your back on God, God is not there for you. It's a very simple, straightforward, and direct message. Let's move on down to the 12th chapter for a moment. What we're going to see in this chapter is the difficulties that Ezekiel was facing, and they're given to us in very graphic language. He had a hard position to take. He he was faced with a complete unwillingness of people to accept what he was saying, and they just wouldn't listen, as it were. And so we have, within the first and second verses of this, the start of the second verse, a very simple statement. Son of man, you live in among a very rebellious people. There's not much else you can say about it. Which have eyes to see and see not, ears to hear and hear not, they're a rebellious house. They're a rebellious house. Look at the 11th verse. And say, I am your sign, said Ezekiel. I am your sign. Because what Ezekiel was doing in those first series of chapters which we've just skipped over was showing them by little dramatic series, by the way he dressed, by the things he did, that their temple in Jerusalem was about to be destroyed. Ezekiel was their sign. Like as I have done, so shall it be done unto them. They shall remove and go into captivity. And we'll see shortly one way in which this was acted out very forcefully in Ezekiel's life. Like as I have done, so it shall be done unto them. They shall remove and go into captivity. The 27th verse, and again the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, Son of man, behold, they of the house of Israel say, the vision that he hath seen is for many days to come. And he prophesieth of times that are far off. And therefore say unto them, thus saith the Lord God, there shall none of my words be prolonged any more, but the word which I have spoken shall be done, saith the Lord. In other words, the response to all of the little acts, the play acting that Ezekiel had done about the destruction of Jerusalem was, oh well, that won't happen. Not for a long time, anyway. We don't have to worry about that. And as we said, at the end of the 20th verse, 20th chapter, is this very cogent little phrase. Lord, they think I speak in parables. Chapter 13, verse 16, to wit, the prophets of Israel, which prophesy concerning Jerusalem, which see visions of peace for her, and there is no peace, saith the Lord. There is no peace. So there were a series of counter-arguments presented. We don't have to worry, said others who considered themselves prophets. The crux of this matter now is introduced to us in the 14th chapter. Middle of the 14th chapter, we meet a very interesting little phrase. Three very famous individuals from the Old Testament are cited. And that leads us then into another rather well-known segment of Ezekiel's prophecy, which is in chapter 18. But we're getting to the crux of the matter here. Ezekiel found himself in a minority position. Ezekiel found himself in an unpopular position. But Ezekiel had been assured that God was with him, and Ezekiel had been given the task of explaining to these people what was going to happen in their history and why it was happening and what the final outcome would be. In the 14th verse of the 14th chapter, though these three men, Noah, Daniel, and Job were in it, they should deliver but their own souls by their righteousness, saith the Lord. In other words, you're responsible for your own acts. You can explain things to people, and that's what Ezekiel was doing. You can stand up and do things which are very dramatic, as Noah did when he built that large barge. You made your witness. But you're not responsible for the decisions which others make. Job was a witness, and Daniel a witness in Babylon. Individually, they were accepted. Their testimony was accepted by God. But it was on them alone. They were individually responsible. And that was the point that Ezekiel needed to be assured of. But it was also the point that he had to drive home to those who were with him. They made their own decisions. They could choose to believe what Ezekiel was saying, or they could discard what he was saying. But nonetheless, they were personally responsible. They had heard his message. Ezekiel seems to be saying there in that 14th chapter, you've heard what I've said. What are you going to do about it? The 18th chapter now. This is a very interesting chapter because it puts things for us in a very New Testament framework. Now remember, we've come to this from Ezekiel's position of being completely overawed by the presence of God. His realization that he did have something critical to do in the service of his God. But it was going to be difficult. He knew that. He knew that. And then we come to things like that verse which we've just looked at. The examples of others from the Old Testament, particularly Job and Noah. And so Ezekiel now has these words to say to those people who approached him on a regular basis. And that seems to be the case. We haven't looked at any of the other examples yet, but there are several of them where the elders come to Ezekiel during the day to hear what he has to say. The word of the Lord came to me again, saying, what mean ye that ye use this proverb concerning the land of Israel, saying, the fathers have eaten sour grapes, and the children's teeth are set on edge? As I live, saith the Lord God, ye shall not have occasion any more to use this proverb in Israel. Behold, all souls are mine. As the soul of the father, so also the soul of the son is mine. The soul that sinneth, it shall die. In other words, every individual in the nation of Israel at that time had made their own personal decisions whether to face the rising sun or whether to face the sanctuary of the Lord. Each one of them had made the decisions within their lives. Now, collectively, they had more of them chosen to face the rising sun. That's obvious from what had happened. Collectively, more of them had decided to face east than to look towards God and the sanctuary, which was in the western end of the temple. But nonetheless, each one of them made their own decision. And that's the point which is here in this chapter. The soul that sinneth, it shall die. But if a man be just, in the fifth verse, and do that which is lawful and right, and hath not eaten upon the mountains. What are we talking about here? We're talking about the groves which we read so much about in the time of Judges and so forth. The high places, which were left intact when the Israelites moved into the land. And it seems that the Israelites, when they established themselves in the land, found that they could control the heights of land more readily than they could control the more fertile valleys. But not only were they living in these areas, but they also seemed to have been worshipping in those areas in the same manner as the people that they had displaced from those religious sanctuaries on the tops of the mountains. That's what's being referred to there. The habit not of going to the altar to Yahweh, but to setting up a grove in a high place where they could worship what they had thought to be right. And that is a very modern idea. And it's something which we really need to grasp, because people nowadays are reasoning their way into all sorts of rational ideas concerning religion. They did that in this day as well. Hath not eaten upon the mountains, neither hath lifted up his eyes to the idols of the house of Israel. And so on it goes. There's a dozen verses in this general topic. We don't need to look at all of them, but it's fascinating that the next one that comes to us is a preoccupation with sex, which is one of the things that's part of our society so much today. So, it's what you choose to do. What you choose to do as an individual, which is important in the eyes of God. The end of the ninth verse. He hath walked in my statutes, hath kept my judgments to deal truly. He is just, he shall live, saith the Lord. You see, there's a little implication there. Something that we meet more in prophets like Malachi, that there was an element of justice, an element of honor, an element of truth which had to be in people's lives. Not just going to the temple as a ritual, not just making your contributions to the temple, not just making sure the sacrifices were presented on time and things like that. But there was also an element of humanity which was important in here, that you didn't look to yourself. You did what you could for those around you, and hath dealt truly and is just. He shall live, saith the Lord God. 20th verse repeats the phrase from the fifth verse. The soul that sinneth, it shall die. The son shall not bear the iniquity of the father. The 22nd verse, in his righteousness that he hath done shall he live. And the 25th verse is really critical, because this was the attitude of the people that were there at that time. The 25th verse is really critical. We started out by saying, fathers have eaten sour grapes and the children's teeth are set on edge. In other words, there's almost a hereditary notion to this sense of sin. Not so much hereditary, but a way of life which is passed on within family groups. You do as you see others do around you. It just goes on that way. You can't help it. It's your background. It's your friends. It's the people you associate with that influence what you're doing. But God said, no. No. You make your own decisions. You make your own decisions where your values are going to be. And yet, everybody said, as they said in the case of Malachi, wherein have we sinned? What have we done wrong? It's the response of a two-year-old. I didn't do it. Why should I? And, you know, it's childish talk, really. Yet we say, the way of the Lord is not equal. Yet, why are you accusing me of this? I haven't done anything. All I did was think very seriously about what I was doing, and I decided that the religion out there was just as good as the one I've got nowadays. That's ecumenism in its boldest form, and it's here with us today. And yet, saith the house of Israel in the 29th verse, again, the way of the Lord is not equal. O house of Israel, are my ways, are not my ways equal? Are not your ways unequal? In other words, God hasn't changed. He set a series of standards before them at the very beginning, and that's one of the points which I hoped to indicate to you when we look just a little bit at the symbolism in the first chapter, that what we're doing in the initial stages is going all the way back to the law of Moses and to the fact that God formed earth, formed this earth, placed us on it, and gave us the means to stay alive and be healthy and strong and do things on this earth, and then within Moses set a framework for his people to live by. For I have no pleasure, said God in the 32nd verse, no pleasure in the death of him that dieth. Wherefore, turn yourselves and live ye. In other words, God didn't like what was going on. These people had been overtaken by calamity. God wasn't pleased by what was going on. But those were the standards that had been set coming out of Moses. Behold, I set before you this day, said God in Deuteronomy, life and death. Which one are you going to choose? The 24th verse, 24th chapter is very poignant. It's really difficult. It's a difficult chapter. Also, the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, Son of man, in the 15th verse of this 24th chapter, behold, I take away from thee the desire of thine eyes with a stroke. Yet neither shalt thou mourn nor weep, and neither shall thy tears run down. Why and what was happening? Behold, I take away from thee the desire of thine eyes. You're not to mourn. You've got to soldier on. Was what was happening here and what was going to come apart. Forbear to cry, make no mourning for the dead, bind the tire, when this was sort of a round hat, tire on your head upon thee, and put your shoes upon your feet, cover not your lips, and eat not the bread of men. So I spake unto the people in the morning. Ezekiel had to keep going. He had a message to deliver in the morning. That night his wife died. Next morning, he went straight back to work. That was what was meant by those preceding verses. And why? Why? Why wasn't Ezekiel given time and given permission to mourn what must have been a very, you know, almost a final blow here? As we said earlier, he'd lost his job and his position. He found himself in a foreign country. Under difficult circumstances, freedom of religion was just about gone for them. And now his personal life was shattered. Speak unto the house of Israel, thus saith the Lord in the 21st verse, behold, I will profane my sanctuary and the excellency of your strength, the desire of your eyes, and that which your soul pitieth, and your sons and your daughters whom ye have left shall fall by the sword, and ye shall do as I have done. Ye shall not cover your lips, nor eat the bread of men, and the tires upon your heads, and your shoes upon your feet. Ye shall not mourn nor weep, but ye shall pine away for your iniquities and mourn one toward another. In other words, what Ezekiel was doing and what God had brought about in his life was what was going to happen to the city of Jerusalem very shortly. They were going to have plenty to mourn about, but no time to do it because they were going to be stuck in chains and dragged off to Babylon. Must have been difficult, extremely difficult, to know what all that was about, to suffer the death of his companion for many, many years, and have to go on with this message. It hasn't ended yet, you fellas. It's only just beginning. Book of Ezekiel is generally thought to be divided into two approximately equal parts, because we have a little summary here at the end of the 24th chapter, which talks about what's coming in the next little while, what's coming in the future. And then we step into language which is cast against the nations round about, and then the Valley of the Dry Bones and so forth, the restitution of the nation of Israel. Then finally into the description of the temple. I want to pick up one little verse right at the very end, in chapter 47. And remind you that this is why we give thanks. And this brings it home to us again. There are all sorts of these very personal and very direct and very simple and straightforward little messages in Ezekiel. Now, you may not notice it. You don't realize that it's coming because we're talking about, you know, great things here in this 47th chapter. We're talking about marvelous symbolism of the land and the surroundings of the new temple and so forth. Right at the end of the 12th verse of the 47th chapter of Ezekiel are these words. We're talking about trees which grow on the banks of the river, which is defined in the beginning of this 47th chapter. And the fruit of these trees shall be for meat, and the leaf thereof for medicine. And we start in Genesis. We're given a picture of the bounty of God's creation and assured that it's there to sustain us and to keep us in health and strength. And then we get to this method of sacrifice and all of the other things that follow therein. Get to the assurance in the rainbow that God will continue to provide these things for us. And then when we get to the end, to this final vision, we see that they're still there. So the message surely has got to be that throughout the pages of human history, God has provided for our welfare, our physical sustenance in the food that we eat, our health, in that we're surrounded by things which can care for us. The medicine, as it says, in the leaves. God has provided a world which will care for us in all our needs. If only with spiritual needs and physical needs, if only we have the attitude which we meet in the first chapter of Ezekiel. In those first three verses, it didn't matter where we are. It made no difference that Ezekiel was far removed from the temple area. If only we look, if only we listen, God is there. But what's our attitude to what God is offering us? Is it an attitude like Ezekiel's of humility? And when Ezekiel saw the glory which God presented before him, he fell on his face. But then he listened. And I heard a voice. So as I hope you realize there's a very personal, a very direct message in this prophet. In a prophet that is always thought of as being wrapped in enigma almost and mystery. But there is a very personal and very direct, a very meaningful human story here. So in next talk, we'll talk about the difficulties that the nation faced in this time. We'll talk about some of the symbols which Ezekiel presented and relate them to the history of the times. And then beyond that to the fact that Ezekiel is offering them a restitution. And we talk about how these relate to us in the third talk and then get back to all the wheels and the symbols which we didn't talk about from the first chapter and so on in the fourth chapter.